Welcome everybody to Four Winds Fellowships. I'm Tim Warner, your teacher. We are in a series of lessons on the nature of God and His Son, probably the most important topic in the entire Bible. Now, we're all aware that there are three monotheistic religions in the world, and they probably compose or make up the vast majority of people who actually believe in a supernatural being. And these, of course, are Judaism and Christianity and Islam. They developed in that order. They all claim that there is one God, and they emphasize the fact that there is one God, but the different religions define what they mean by one God a little bit differently. The Jews believe that there is one Almighty God, but they also believe in the Messiah, who is called the Son of God. Now, most of the Jews don't believe that the Messiah is literally the Son of God. They believe he is the adopted Son of God, but still they refer to him as the Son of God. Christianity has a variety of views. Of course, the most common one is Trinitarianism, which defines God as three persons. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later on in this lesson, and whether that is even a valid claim, if it can be supported by logic or by the scriptures. But there are other Christians who believe that God is only one person, the Father alone, yet they recognize that the Son of God is also on occasion called God. There's no question about that. Then, of course, we have Islam, which claims that Allah alone is God. There is no other God beside Allah, and they also, as part of their faith, claim that Allah has no son, and Allah does not beget, all right, which is different from what we see in Christianity and in Judaism. So, excuse me, what we want to do, we talked last time about the process that we're going to use in trying to come to the truth, and that the process must be objective, and we must weed out personal biases. We're not here to try to prove that our viewpoint is true by, you know, selectively grabbing different verses out of context, but we're going to look at the scriptures kind of as a whole and progressively to try to understand what they're teaching, to build line upon line, precept upon precept. And so the definition of the word God is extremely important. It has to be settled at the very beginning. And the what God means when he says, when he refers to himself as the one and only God, or true God. All right, so let's look at these scriptures we have here on the screen. Pardon my cough. Exodus 12:12 says, "Against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord." So that passage right there, it's talking about the plagues that God was going to bring on Egypt when he brought Israel out of slavery. And he announces that he's going to bring his plagues on the gods of Egypt. In Exodus chapter 18, verse 11, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, after Moses brings them out of Egypt, he says, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. For in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them." Now note the fact that they behaved, these gods behaved in a certain way, but that God, the Lord, Yahweh, was above them in how he behaved. And so he's comparing the power, he's comparing the authority, the demonstration of God's power. He's comparing the God of Israel with the pagan gods there. All right, so he's drawing a contrast between them. And in Numbers 33:4, it says, "For the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had killed among them. Also on their gods, the Lord had executed judgments." Again, we have the very same thing. And then Exodus 15:11, "Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods?" Again, we have a contrast between the God of Israel and the gods of all the other nations. Exodus 20, verse 3. This is the first of the Ten Commandments. God says, you shall have no other gods before me. Now, the mere fact that he mentions other gods indicates that there are other gods. Now, how we define those other gods is also important, and we'll look at that in the next slide. But the thing I want you to see right off the bat is that the Bible many times, and this is just a very brief sampling of statements that refer to the gods of the nations. What we're looking for here is not what God consists of, not his nature per se. We're simply looking to define the word. Because the word God, which is Elohim in Hebrew and Theos in Greek, the word God has a specific definition. But what's important is that the same term is used for the God of Israel. It's used for the Son of God on a few occasions, and it's also used for false gods as well. That is the gods of the nations, the pagan gods. All right. So it's important to understand that whatever definition we form for this word has to take into account its usage, its entire usage. All right. So we need to develop our definition of the word God or gods from the biblical usage. All right. Okay. So let's look at the next slide. Pardon me. The Bible is very clear that the pagan gods are, in fact, actual conscious beings. They are entities, okay, that have a mind and a will and can act. That's important. I mean, in the previous slide, that wasn't absolutely clear. But in these slides, it's very clear. Let's look at these all these statements that refer to the pagan gods as demons. For you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and make sacrifice to their gods. All right, now what he's talking about, what does he mean by play the harlot? See, if God is a jealous God, then he's not jealous of a block of wood. He's not jealous of a stone carving. God is jealous of when his people worship or have loyalty to other beings besides him, right? So he uses this language all throughout the Old Testament of Israel's harlotry when they sacrifice to the pagan gods. In Leviticus 17:7, it says, they shall no more offer their sacrifices to demons after whom they have played the harlot. So you see, in that verse, you see the connection between God using this expression of harlotry when Israel was worshiping the pagan gods, and also to the connection to that these are in fact demons, right? Now, we also see the word demons used in the New Testament. There were demons that, and also they're referred to as evil spirits, which Jesus cast out of certain people who were causing them to act a certain way. And on some occasions, those demons spoke, and Christ spoke to them, telling them to come out and so forth. So they're clearly conscious beings that we're referring to here. Deuteronomy 32:17. They sacrificed to demons, not to God, to gods they did not know, to new gods, new arrivals that your fathers did not fear. So again, we have the connection between demons, which are evil spirits, these pagan gods. Psalm 106:37. They even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons. Again, that was to specific gods, which we can read about that in Jeremiah and other places. Now, the New Testament says something about this as well, and I thought I would include this passage also. In 1 Corinthians 10, 20 through 21, the Apostle Paul in this passage was talking about eating food sacrificed to idols. And he talks about that Christians shouldn't, you know, be too concerned that if they go to the meat market, whether or not the food had been, when it was slaughtered, whether it was slaughtered at a pagan temple, which was common in those days, and dedicated to a god, and then it's sold in the meat markets. You don't know where that food came from. So, you know, he's telling them, you don't need to be that concerned about that. But when it came to any kind of activity where Christians would be knowingly partaking of meat that had been sacrificed to idols or sacrificed in the worship of idols, he forbid that. And so he, when he's talking about that, he says here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he says, rather the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. So Paul drew the line as far as, you know, whether you can eat food that had been sacrificed to idols, pagan gods, by accident because you happen to buy some at a meat market and you don't know where that food came, where that meat came from, or you are invited to someone's house and they, you know, they may have purchased it from some place that sold meat from, you know, this sort of thing. He says to eat whatever is set before you, asking no questions. In other words, if you don't know where it's coming from, and it's clear that that's not something that is being made known at the dinner, then don't make an issue out of it. But if it is known to be sacrificed to demons and that is part of the meal, then you're not to partake of it. And he talks about them, you know, these things being sacrificed to demons. So anyway, in the New Testament and the Old Testament, it's clear, it's consistent. There's several passages in Revelation also that talk about these pagan gods being demons as well. So we shouldn't dismiss the fact that pagan gods are idols. There are many times, you know, the Bible talks about the pagan gods are idols and idols can't do anything. Yes, those are just the representations of the gods who were actual beings, right? So the point I want you to see very clearly here is that there are many gods. Paul actually says this in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. There are many gods, but for us there is one God. All right, and that's the distinction that the Apostle Paul made. All right, so my reasoning behind going through all of this, showing you that there are other beings that are called gods, is because we want to define and narrowly define the word God so that every time it's used in the Bible, we can have a single definition of it, and we don't play musical chairs with the word God, as many people actually do, which is a fallacy. All right, and we'll talk about that a little more later. All right, let's look at the next slide. In Exodus 23, we read this previously. It says, this is the first of the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me. So that statement right there acknowledges that there are other gods. And he's telling Israel, you're not to worship the gods that the Egyptians worship, which are demons. You are to worship me alone. All right. And this is the essence of the one God statements in the scripture. It's that for you, my people, there can only be one God. Then that's me. Okay. He's a jealous God. In Deuteronomy 6:4, this is a passage that's used frequently by Unitarians and Jews to show that, to try to counter the idea that of the Trinity, that God is three persons, that God can only be one person, and they use this particular verse. Let's look at it. Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Now, does that verse mean that the Lord is the only entity that can be called God? No, it doesn't mean that, because we just showed that the Bible demonstrates many, many times that there are many gods, and those gods are demons. Not only that, God's Son is called God in a couple of places. He's called God in Psalm 45, I think it's 6 and 7. And then that passage is quoted in Hebrews chapter 1, and it says to the Son, that the Psalm says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever, a scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom, and so forth. But then it says, your God. God, your God has anointed you, that has given you this place of being God, right? So the term God has to accommodate both God himself, has to accommodate its use with the Son of God. It has to accommodate its use with all of these foreign and pagan gods as well. All right, so that's really important that we understand that. Deuteronomy 32, 9 through 12. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in a wasteland, a howling wilderness. He encircled him. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. As the apple stirs up its nest, as the eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings, so the Lord alone, or Yahweh alone, led him. Now, he defines this, what he means by Yahweh alone. Look at this. There was no foreign God with him. So what is this passage saying? This is from the Song of Moses, Deuteronomy 32. And God is telling them all the things that he did to deliver them out of Egypt, brought them into gave them his law. He was bringing them into the promised land and all these things that he did. And he says he alone led them. But then he says there was no foreign God with them. In other words, those foreign gods in Egypt that God brought his judgment upon when he brought all those plagues, he overthrew the foreign gods of Egypt. Those gods didn't help you escape from Egypt. That's what he's saying, right? I did that. They were not a part of that. Now let's look at Isaiah 45, 5 through 7, and then verses 12 and verse 18. This is a really important passage because it talks specifically about there is no other God beside Yahweh. I am the Lord, there is no other. There is no God beside me. I will gird you, though you have known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create calamity. I, the Lord, do all these things. I have made the earth and created man on it. I, my hands, stretched out the heavens, and all their hosts I have commanded. For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. Now, he's not saying I am the only God. He's saying I am the only God who can do all these things. I am the only one who created the heavens and the earth. Those other gods, those pagan gods. Now, the thing you have to understand is that the pagan gods were all claimed to have power and authority over some particular aspect of nature. That is, these demons deceived the pagans into believing that they could control aspects of nature. And this is why when you look at the pagan deities, they have, you know, like the Egyptians had Ra, the sun god. You know, they had a god of the Nile. They had that was supposed to control the flooding of the Nile annually, which then would, you know, help produce their crops. They had a goddess of fertility. They had gods of war. They had for every aspect of nature or every aspect of human life, they had a god who allegedly had sovereignty over that particular thing. And so they would sacrifice if they, you know, if they were having, the Nile was not, you know, flooding like they thought it should to help fertilize their crops, they would sacrifice to the god of the Nile. Or, you know, the weather, they would sacrifice to the sun god. Or the, you know, if they they would sacrifice, if they're going to war, they would sacrifice to their war gods, so that they would have favor by these gods in these particular situations. And this is how all the pantheons of pagan gods were supposed to work. And so God is countering that kind of mentality, because when he keeps saying that he is God and there's no God beside him, it's in the context of what he has done and what he can do, right? So he says, when he says that he has created everything, he's created the heavens and he's created the earth, what he means is, obviously, the one who creates something has the power to control it. And so what he's letting them know is that these demons, they pretend to have power in order to get people to worship them, but they don't actually have that power, right? So when he says there's none beside me, he's essentially saying there's none who can do these things that I have done and that I can do. All right, that's really, really important. All right, so let's move on to our next slide. So how do we define this word God? What is the one meaning of it? And this is where the different isms, Trinitarianism, Unitarianism, and some of the other isms play musical chairs with the word God. And I want to sort of head that concept off immediately and show what the word God means and what it doesn't mean, so that we don't give a lot of these isms ground to misuse the term God in order to prop up their particular version of theology. All right. So what does the word God really mean? Well, I think Psalm 45, which I briefly quoted before, where it says, your throne, O God, and it's talking to the Son, according to Hebrews chapter 1. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You love righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil above your companions. Now, anointed was what a king. Kings were anointed. And so in that passage, we have God Almighty, Yahweh God, anointing his Son to be God in the kingdom, in his kingdom, right, when he reigns. It's clear there that the first phrase, your throne, O God, is referring to one who's reigning, because he's on a throne and he has a scepter and he has a kingdom, right? And when it says God, your God, has anointed you, it's clear that there is someone above him who is his God. So what does it mean that someone is your God, or someone is Israel's God? What does that mean? It means that person being called God, is the one who holds the sovereignty over those people. All right. So when the Bible, many times in the New Testament, refers to the Father as Jesus' own God, all right, there's several verses that use that kind of terminology. So Jesus has a God, and Jesus' God is the Father. But the Father is the God over all. And when we get into the book of Revelation, you'll see that God, there's a particular phrase it's used a few other times in the Bible, but it's used several times in Revelation. And it's Pantocrator. Pantocrator literally means sovereign over all. And that's what Yahweh is claiming. See, these pagan gods claimed sovereignty over one thing, one aspect of nature, and it was a false claim. But God is the true God, because he really does have sovereignty over absolutely everything, because he is the source of everything that was created. He's the creator, and he is the sovereign over all that he has created. So his sovereignty comes from the fact that he created everything. All right, that's really important. So if we're going to define the word God, and once we define the word God, that's going to be our definition every time it appears in the Bible. All right. So God, the word God, which is Elohim in Hebrew, and it's Theos in Greek. It is the being with ultimate sovereignty over a dominion, right? Now, Christ is called God over his kingdom when he reigns for 1,000 years on the earth, because that's his dominion that has been assigned to him and delegated to him by his God, which is the Father, all right? So the word God is applied in all these various ways that you see there on your screen, all right? It's applied to the one true God, and in fact, that actual expression is used, the one true God. of Yahweh God, the Father, because he holds sovereignty over everything. He is the ultimate sovereign. And then the Son of God is delegated with us with certain spheres of dominion, and he is God in those spheres of dominion, but not God in the sense of God the Father having lost his dominion over him, because he is, this is all delegated to him. All right, that's the important point. And then, of course, the pagan gods pretend to have sovereignty over aspects of nature, which is why they're called gods. And then in Psalm chapter 81, it's also quoted in the Gospel of John, there are human kings that are sort of sarcastically referred to as gods, because God is the one who has given human government and human authority, yet they were abusing it, and so God chastises them, and he sarcastically refers to them as gods. But these are all the occurrences in the Bible of the word God are going to fall into one of those four categories. But my point is that the definition of the term doesn't change. All right. It's only shaped by the context. All right. I think we understand that concept. So here's something else that we need to be pay attention to. And that is that the word God in both Hebrew and in Greek is not an abstract noun. It is a concrete noun. Well, what's the difference between an abstract and a concrete noun? Concrete noun is something that can be, that actually exists, that can be in a place, right? There are abstract nouns. Abstract nouns are things that can, are concepts. Things that are not an actual thing that is in existence, but merely things that can be conceived of in the mind. So it's important to understand that God is always a concrete noun. It is never an abstract noun. And this is where both Trinitarians and Unitarians play fast and loose with the word God in certain circumstances in order to explain away the difficult passages for their view. But that is simply a device that goes against any kind of objective or interpretive principles. All right, and our interpretive principles have to be objective. The word God has to define what the passage that's using it means. We can't just simply change the definition of the word God in order to make the passage agree with our theology. All right, we'll talk about that again in just a minute. So it's always a concrete noun. It's never abstract. It is always a personal noun, that it always refers to a person, a being, a conscious being, an entity. All right. It never refers to just one particular characteristic of God or something like that. That would be abstract. All right. It's always concrete. It's always personal. It's always a relational term. Now, there are several relational terms in the Bible, like father, mother, child, wife, husband, governor, king. These are all relational terms. Is there such a thing as a father if he hasn't had any children? No, he's not a father. Is there such a thing as a wife who's not married? No, right? A husband, a wife, father, child. All those terms require a counterpart in order for that person to be that thing. All right, well, the same thing is true of God. The word God requires a dominion. It requires subjects. Similar to the way the word king requires a dominion and subjects. But there is one thing that the word God has that the word king doesn't have. A king may have dominion, but he does not necessarily have power over his subjects. All right, he has authority over his subjects. But if his subjects rise up against him and defeat him, he may not have power over his subjects. All right, the word God also implies power. That is power, ultimate power over the dominion, not only authority. All right, so it's power and authority over whatever dominion the context is talking about. All right, let me just shut off my alarm here. All right, now let's look at, I mentioned before that there are Trinitarians, Unitarians, and then us, Four Winds Fellowships, and there are others besides us that use the term correctly. But I wanted to point out the errors that the Trinitarians and Unitarians use and how they play musical chairs with the word God, right? And we're just not going to let that happen. All right, so Trinitarians will interpret the word God as we have defined it. That is, it's a concrete, personal, relational noun. Whenever it refers to either the Father or the Son or the Spirit, they will say, oh yes, it's a concrete noun. Yes, it's personal, it's relational. Yes, it's exactly as we have defined it, right? But they interpret God as an abstract, impersonal, and non-relational noun in those passages that refer to one God and the use of singular pronouns. Now, the Bible talks about one God many times, and we've looked at a few of those. There are also literally thousands of times that the singular personal pronoun, he or him, is used of God and throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament as well, right? And they're singular, they're not plural. And so they will, of course, the pronoun obviously is simply repeating the meaning of whatever its antecedent is, and that in most cases it's talking about the one true God, right? So it's singular God. So you can point to the word God as being singular, theos in Greek, or you can point to the personal pronouns as being singular and say that, well, that's not three persons, that's one person, because personal pronouns have to do with persons. And they will say, well, yes, but in those passages, the word God is abstract. That is, the word God is referring to the divine essence. And so it becomes, okay, there's a divine stuff or divine essence that's shared by three persons. But see, what they're doing is they're eliminating it, the word God being a personal noun, they're eliminating it being a concrete noun, and they're even eliminating it being a relational noun when they do that, right? Now, why do they do that? Because how else are you going to accommodate one God, all the one God statements, but your claim that there are three persons who are collectively one God? See, this is the problem that Trinitarians run into. So they redefine the word God and make it an abstract noun. Well, you would think Unitarians would call them on that, right? Because Unitarians believe that there is one ultimate God who is the Father alone, and that the Son and the Spirit are not God in the same sense, eternal God, as the Father is. But they do the same thing. They do it in, for one example, they do it in John chapter 1, where it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, the word God there is a personal noun. It's a concrete noun. It refers to a person who has a relationship with those under his dominion. And the Word is God. That statement right there means that the Word, Logos, is a person who was with God at the beginning. And that's the only thing it can mean, unless you play fast and loose with the definition of the word God in that clause. So now the word was God becomes, well, the word was a divine plan. That is, it was something that's not really God, but it had some characteristics, some abstract characteristics that's shared with God. No, that's not what the text says. All right. And that is being extraordinarily subjective. It's doing exactly the same things Trinitarians use. And my point is that Unitarians really have no basis to call out Trinitarians when they say that, well, God in the passages that refer to one God, that, that's talking about, one divine essence that's shared by three persons. And so that's how they can make three into one. Unitarians have no basis for calling them out on fudging of the term God and that kind of interpretation, because they do exactly the same thing in John chapter 1, verse 1. All right? They do the same thing. Well, if we're going to be objective, we can't do that. We can't play musical chairs with the word God. The word God has to mean the same thing all the time, everywhere it appears in the Bible, or we are not being honest and objective with the text. All right, so At Four Winds Fellowships, we insist that the word God has a single definition that fits its application everywhere it appears in the Bible. All right? That's a really important topic there. All right. Well, that's it for today. We've defined the word God. We're going to start in the first chapter of Genesis next time. And we're going to start trying to progressively work our way through the Bible to see what it has to say about the creation and this God of Israel. All right. God bless, and we'll see you next time.